Les colloques du Collège de France.
Good morning, everybody. It's great to see you all. So today, I'm going to talk about Committing to Grow, Privatization and Firm Dynamics in East Germany. And this is joint work with Harun Alp from Federal Reserve Board, Andre Digman and Nicholas Serrano Velarde. So maintaining high employment is often the primary goal of industrial policy. And these days, again, we are in a phase of talking very heavily about industrial policy. And a common practice when it comes to, you know, part of the industrial policy is also to privatize firms. And one of the common practice during privatization is to impose some employment targets. And there are many, many examples. For instance, the British Railway privatization, Deutsche Telekom, public utilities in France, United Airlines. There are many, many examples. Whenever there's privatization, the major concern is, of course, the backlash from the society that people will lose their jobs. And as a result, you know, the unemployment will increase. So that's why there's a big push for against the privatization. And the policymakers try to smooth the transition by imposing some employment guarantees upon privatization. And these are extremely common. Indeed, you know, around every privatization, you just keep hearing the same type of arguments. It's very, very popular. But unfortunately, it's an understudied issue in the sense that what is the impact of these employment targets that are being imposed on firms? It's not very well studied, partly because of the lack of systematic data on all these privatization episodes and what happens afterwards. And we will break that barrier by utilizing a brand new data. So the big picture research question that we are posing is, what are the impacts of employment guarantees in the form of labor commitments on productivity and firm dynamics? So that's the big picture question that we are asking. And we are going to utilize a very nice new large-scale micro data that will allow us to do very deep dive analysis. And this is a brand new data on the privatization of 12,000 East German firms right after the wall came down. So brief, super brief history. Of course, Germany got reunited in 1990s. And at the time, of course, you know, the politicians were promising very rosy days to workers and citizens in the east side of Germany. And of course, you know, the major issue back then was that a lot of the companies were being owned by the government. And all these companies had to be privatized, and there was an election upcoming in 1994. And Helmut Kohl at the time found this little opportunity, little window of opportunity to pull the trigger and get the privatization, the reunification done within a very short period of time. So, of course, they were in a rush. They were trying to privatize a lot of companies. And so what they did is they formed this Treuhandanstalt, which is the privatization agency. Initially, the agency had only 200 agents to privatize firms, but we are talking about 12,000 companies to be dealt by 200 people. Of course, that was not possible. They borrowed a lot of privatization agents from East German managers. So from West German managers. A lot of West German managers came over, and they were in charge with privatizing these firms. And literally, there was no clear guidance. And these people who came from West, they were giving a handout and a manual and asked them to privatize firms using their expertise and their own discretion. So that's how they privatized 12,000 firms in such a short period of time. Again, election was upcoming. And of course, when firms start to get privatized, people start to lose their jobs and unemployment start to increase very fast. Unemployment went effectively from 0% to 16% in just a very short period of time. And people were very unhappy with this, as you can imagine. And the blame was put on Treuhand. And the head of the Treuhand agency got assassinated in 1991. And he died. So then the agency, upon that event, you know, changes really its strategy, and rather than doing full due diligence in terms of, you know, finding the right price, indeed they switch their strategy and they start putting labor commitments, because the main problem is that there's bleeding, right? There's a massively rising unemployment, and to stop the rise in unemployment, they said, buy this company, and here's the price tag, which is you're going to have 10,000 workers on during the next 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 8 years, so depending on the contract. So this is, of course, for economists like us, this gives us an amazing opportunity because we have a very large scale data with heterogeneous labor commitments that are being imposed on firms, and these are specific employment targets basically, and it's depending on the contract, it varies between 2 to 8 years. And these are enforced strictly because, again, this is the top of the agenda, basically. Preserving the employment is top of the agenda. And these were monitored strictly through audits and penalties. So we have very detailed data on the privatization contracts. Indeed, we can observe all the details, who was in charge, what were the details of the contract, etc. So we are going to utilize many of that information in our analysis. But before we go into the details, of course, you know, microdata is very rich. It's easy to get lost in the middle of massive microdata. We all know that. So that's why it's always good to use economic theory to guide the analysis. So that's why in the paper, we are starting with a very simple model to derive some intuition and to come up with some testable implications. And let me tell you a little bit about the model. It's a very, very simple, simple production function. Cobb-Douglas between labor and productivity. Z is the productivity, and L is the labor that the firm is hiring, and this is a simple production function. And the main difference now is that the government says there's a labor target L star, and for any deviation from L star, if the firm falls short from L star, then the firm has to pay a cost per each labor that they are falling short. As a result, the maximization problem normally is simply revenue minus the labor cost in the absence of any extra punishment. But because of this labor target, now we have this additional term at the end. So if the firm is not able to meet the employment target, then it has to pay proportional to the number of workers that that it cannot match. So if you compare, indeed, what's really interesting in this very simple problem is the following. Normally, so if you just look at this maximization problem here without the last term, it's just a simple variable cost that's being introduced here. But if you rewrite this last expression, indeed the maximization term, the maximization equation looks like as if now we have a variable cost that's slightly different than the unconstrained maximization. The variable cost goes down by gamma, but now we are introducing a fixed cost. Why is it so? Because the government simply says that I want you to hire 1,000 workers no matter what. Even if you hire zero people, you're going to pay me for those 1,000 workers no matter what. And then if the government, or you know, gamma times the actual wage, and if the government, if the firm now starts actually hiring people, gamma fraction is already paid upfront in terms of the fixed cost because the government is already forcing the firm to pay the gamma fraction of it no matter what. Now it's as if the firm is getting reimbursed for gamma fraction of the wage, and as a result the variable cost goes from WL to 1 minus gamma times WL. So there's a fixed cost and lower variable cost. So then what's the implication? Very simple. So this is the maximization problem the firms are solving, revenue minus cost. We are maximizing this difference. Of course, the standard maximization says that this is the equilibrium normally, or the optimal labor choice. But after the labor regulation, and of course, there are many, many firms with different productivities. In that case, depending on the productivity of the firm, the equilibrium labor allocation will just keep rising in the productivity of the firm, obviously, in the absence of any labor commitment. But if the government imposes some labor commitment, as I said, the cost structure changes from a linear line, it becomes a V-shaped cost structure like this. And in that case, now we will have very different behavior by different firms. If this is the cost structure now, let's go back to the maximization. Now we have these firms at the very bottom that are not viable anymore. Because in the absence of any labor commitment, all the firms are viable. They will all operate, maybe hiring very small amount of workers, but they will all hire workers. Now, because of the fixed cost, very low productivity firms cannot recover the fixed cost. As a result, they will make big losses. And as a result, the first group of firms, after the introduction of this commitment, will decide to exit. So that's why these very low productivity firms will exit. Then there's a second group of firms that are negatively, so they are making negative profit, but they will still decide to stay in the economy because it's a dynamic, of course, firms are living in a dynamic world. They will think that maybe in the future I can improve my productivity and start making positive profit. Maybe in the future from having this shape production function, I can jump to this production function or this production function. So that's why in a dynamic sense, maybe in the short run, I can afford making some negative losses, but I will recover it. So that's why the second group of firms, they will still make negative profit, but they will stay around. But since the variable cost is now lower, they will have a distorted choice. Okay? So rather than hiring here, since it's cheaper now on the margin, they will hire more workers. Then we have the third group. Now these firms are also distorted, but they are making positive profit. The fourth group of firms, now they are willing to increase their labor, but their optimal, new optimal, according to this lower variable cost, their optimal is to the right of the labor commitment. But when you go to the right, now the cost is steeper, right? Because of the V shape, now it's a corner solution effectively, and these firms start to bunch. And then the very productive ones are totally undistorted. Now, as you can see, even though this used to be the undistorted choices, now we have this distorted shape here. And as a result, the first impact of this policy is it's pushing some very unproductive firms out, and other firms are being pushed up. So up or out type of effect, and that's what we call the polarization effect. This is what happens on the static margin. And if we look at the profit, without any labor regulation, this is the profit line, a straight line. Once you introduce the labor commitment, the profit function takes this shape. Since they are paying the fixed cost, now there are some firms that are very unproductive. They will have to make negative losses. But then as their productivity increases, their profit goes back to the straight line. Why am I emphasizing the shape of the profit? Because when it comes to the dynamics and when it comes to the R&D choice, of course, the shape of the profit function determines the shape of the value function, which itself determines the incentive to innovate. The steeper is the value function, the more aggressive firms will try to innovate. So as a result, these firms are exiting, but conditional on surviving in the economy, since the profit function is steeper, these firms will be more aggressive to innovate, because now they will try to innovate out of necessity. They are being cornered, pushed to the corner, and these firms will start innovating out of necessity. Okay?
Look, I think it's only 5 minutes. But
5 minutes. Okay. Okay. Sounds good. So, of course, when it comes to the dynamics, we need to solve for the value function here, and the value function will predict that when you take the dynamics into account, those firms, conditional on survival, will now try to improve their productivity more. So what are the predictions coming from this model? First, employment, these labor commitments are generating the polarization effect. They are pushing the very low productivity firms to out, and the ones that are surviving in the static sense are hiring more, just statically. And then mid-productivity firms will bunch if they are right below the employment target. And in the dynamic sense, firms will innovate out of necessity, especially if the labor target has a long horizon. So if it's just 1 year, probably, I will be okay paying the cost. But if I'm exposed for 8 years, for instance, now instead of paying for 8 years this cost, I better improve my productivity, invest in costly R&D and improve my productivity. So as a result, there will be productivity growth. Empirics. So let me show you, again, the data is very detailed. This is the estimated distribution of firms without the labor commitment. Zero is the difference between the realized employment and the committed employment. And normally, this should be the undistorted distribution of firms. But after the policy, This is the distribution. So depending on the labor commitment, the firms and their initial position, firms are trying to put themselves right above the target. So as a result, when we calculate the excess mass above the labor commitment, it's about 25%. So 25% of the firms are creating excess mass right above their target. This is the employment growth. This is, you know, on the x-axis, we have the ratio of initial size of the firm and the final target. One means that they are exactly at the target initially. If they are to the left, it means that they are already below the target and they need to grow. If they are above, then the commitment target is not binding for them initially. And what we see here is that if they are far from the target, they are growing much faster. So there's a much faster employment growth if they are below the target and they are trying to, again, try to minimize the cost that they are paying to the government. Of course, there's a concern about endogeneity. These contracts are not being distributed randomly. You will impose a binding contract, especially if you know or if you anticipate that the firm is going to shrink. And this is exactly why we have labor commitment, right? If you know that the firm is going to shrink, you are trying to force them to keep the employment. So as a result, you would expect that the OLS should be downward biased. Why? Because exactly those binding contracts should be given to the firms that are more likely to have a low employment growth. So that's why we have to do an IV analysis here. And what we are going to do is we are going to use the leniency of the privatizer. We are going to focus on each privatizer that have at least five contracts that they dealt with. And for instance, if a privatizer dealt with five contracts, we are going to look at the remaining four contracts, except the focal contract, and see, look at the fraction of times the agent is giving a binding contract. So that way we can see how sensitive the agent is towards employment, basically. And using that leniency, we are doing both OLS and the correction. And as you would expect, indeed, the IV results are significantly stronger. These firms, again, remember, these firms were trying to get rid of the workers as much as possible. This is not a small turbulent time. These were oversized firms. So as a result, they were firing a lot of workers, and you would expect a significant difference between IV and OLS, and that's exactly what we find between OLS and IV. Then when we look at the exit probability, again, as the model predicts, for those firms that are very far from target, they are much more likely to exit. And as the firm's employment is growing, they are more likely to survive in the economy. So we see this up or out or dynamics already in the data. And when we look at the productivity, this was another prediction coming from the model. We also see a faster productivity growth by the firms that were below the employment target. So if they were below, the model predicts that there has to be out of necessity improvement in productivity, and that's also something that the model generates. And we also try to see if patenting is happening more frequently, and indeed if the firm was facing a binding contract, they were much more likely to produce a patent after the commitment, basically. And then another, of course, prediction coming from the model was that if the contract horizon is long, then we know that R&D is costly. If the contract horizon is long, then it will be worthwhile for the firm to invest in costly R&D and to improve its productivity. And that's also what we see in the data. For the short horizon contracts, we don't see a significant effect, but if the horizon of the contract is long, then the binding contract has much stronger impact on the productivity growth of the firm. We have some quantitative results too, but I'm out of time. So the only thing I would like to conclude here is that, first, we are not making any welfare statement here. Indeed, we are just trying to make a positive analysis, trying to see how such labor regulations are influencing firm behavior. And it looks like, of course, you know, here the government is distorting the choices of the firm, both statically and dynamically. And as a result, there is some productivity improvement. But just in this analysis, we are showing that if the government had targeted the technology of the firms rather than just trying to stop the bleeding in the short run. If the government had a longer-term perspective and trying to improve the technological infrastructure of these firms, in the long run, the economy could have done a lot better and the labor would have grown organically. And these graphs are showing that when you do the simulation where, for instance, for two periods, there is a government binding contract, and after 2 years, the government lifts the contract, lifts the labor targets, employment starts to come down again. Because the firms didn't improve their productivity as much, but if the government had targeted East German firms' technology directly, maybe in the short run, labor wouldn't have recovered very quickly, but in the long run, the economy would have done significantly better. Indeed, today, when we compare East Germany to West Germany, the productivity gap is still 20%. So 20% lower productivity in East than West. So let me stop here. So thank you very much.
Okay, this is a pleasure to discuss this paper. I get to talk later, so I'll say some things about Zvi when I have a little bit more of a budget. So on this paper, very nice paper. I rationally knew that Ufuk would do a great job presenting and have beautiful graphics, so I'll have just mostly words. He was really clear on what they find. Let me just add to what he was saying, that the annual rates of these are the IV estimates, that's why I have stricter, so a stricter privatization, I guess, agent, I don't know what to call them exactly, is associated with 25% higher annual employment growth for several years. And 10% higher productivity growth for several years, and about a 1% higher exit rate. And the paper has a model, as you saw, that has that happen endogenously. So here are a couple pictures. He showed you this, both of these already, so I think I'll go straight to the comments. So fascinating episode in policy, so really cool that they're studying that. And I think the model is suitable for motivating the kind of basic forces that happen in response. Impressive, like in much of Ufuk's work, impressive marshalling of several sources of data so that you can really see what happened and understand mechanisms. Of course, great to have this leniency instrument so that you don't have to rely completely on the OLS. And the facts comport very well with the model. Again, the model is designed maybe to explain that, but still it's not always easy to do, so I appreciated that for sure. So comments, as he mentioned, IV versus OLS, I'm going to comment about that, a little about dynamic misallocation, a potential thing to add on relative wages, and a topic about enforceability. Okay, so IV versus OLS. Maybe this is just a macro phenomenon, but it always seems like the IV coefficients are bigger than the OLS. And I remember somebody posting on Twitter, why is this? What should I do? And I reply, I almost never post anything on Twitter, but I replied, I replied that maybe there's measurement error in the independent variable. So when you instrument that, that'll cause it. And I thought that was like the standard explanation. And Jeff Woolridge, prominent person, posts, that's the last scoundrel, last refuge of scoundrels. That's a bad motivation. I was like, oh. Fortunately, here, Ufuk has a plausible story for why OLS is downward biased, which is that they're trying to protect these jobs. They see the firm shrinking, and so they say, we got to put some targets to keep them from shrinking, to make sure that they either don't lay them off or maybe rehire them. They're trying, if you think of the motivation of the policy, it's precisely to avoid all this disruption. So here was a really good explanation for it. I want to add, though, that means that if this firm was not just below the target, but was heading farther below the target, then that's going to generate more misallocation, more static misallocation to force them not only to not be below the target, but fall farther below the target if that's what they wanted to do. So the paper could do more without too much effort of like calculating the static misallocation generated by this policy. It's a decision problem that they're modeling. There's no general equilibrium. That's fine. The paper does a ton. I don't think it needs to do that. But it could make the assumption that, and it's not an assumption, just say of the labor that's used in the industry, what's the TFP versus if you reallocated that across those exact same total employment across those firms to equate the static marginal product. My guess is it's a couple percent, but I don't know. That would be an easy thing to calculate. Another side comment to that is that the model very much reminds me of Lucas Spana control, not the dynamic part about the productivity investment, but like the Z could be managerial ability as opposed to disembodied productivity. What that might be worth a subsection, because it might be plausible that they say, we need to try to keep from shrinking, maybe we need to bring in better managers. That would have more of a zero-sum component, because then those managers would be bid away from other firms. You wouldn't necessarily have this expansion of productivity. So I think that the difference could matter. Okay, a second comment is about, in modeling this endogenous productivity investment, the paper does reference the static misallocation, but it doesn't really say that this could actually be a bad thing, right? We don't necessarily always want more investment, and imagine there's a fixed amount of output that's going to be devoted to productivity improvements in the industry, then this can be a misallocation of that investment towards firms with worse opportunities but with a high employment target relative to their actual. So you could calculate that too. So both of these calculations of how much static misallocation is there, how much dynamic misallocation is there, don't require solving for the general equilibrium, worrying about elasticity of labor supply. There's other stuff for, I think, a future paper to do building on this that would, but this paper is great and I don't think it needs to do this, but a future paper could not only do the general equilibrium with, you know, rigid wages, but also have things like unemployment and effects on inequality. Because one of the motivations of this may be perfectly consistent with a social welfare function where these workers would be laid off and their consumption would plummet. And so, you know, we could provide other social insurance, but this might be an efficient second best alternative to providing, you know, payments into unemployment. Okay, so the dynamic misallocation, again, not surprisingly, I'm seeing the world, seeing the paper through the prism of misallocation. So you could misallocate employment at a point in time, but also the R&D investments, and ask how big those effects are on productivity. So this was a side comment that might not be right, but a side comment in the paper is that the wage, it's part of the employment target penalty. So if you deviate from the employment target, what's the penalty? Well, it's gamma times the wage. The wage, they say, is the industry average wage. So that introduces another source of heterogeneity, if I interpret it correctly, which is that if I'm above average industry wage, my penalty's smaller. If I'm below average industry wage, my penalty's higher relative to my wage bill. The firm should respond to that. They can see if that's true in the data, and if it's true, that's another source of static misallocation and maybe dynamic misallocation too. Okay, the last thing is about enforceability. Ufuk said, hey, a better policy might be, you know, just subsidizing productivity, but I just wanted to say, you know, there's a small part of the productivity literature that many people out here must know infinitely better than I do that says, you know, in our models we have R&D and we can subsidize it, but often firms can play games with the accounting. And that could be like this recent paper by Chen Liu, Suarez Suato, and Daniel Zhu in the AER modeled how firms shifted from other overhead to R&D in China in response to a big increase in the R&D tax credit. And so they estimated how much of the increase in R&D was real versus just a figment. So I mentioned that because this policy might be easier to enforce. Employment might be harder to fake, you know, easier to monitor than R&D effort. So you can always game employment, of course. Either you misreport, but again, it might be easier to measure. You're always worried that maybe they'll combine two firms and say, we hit our target, and combine with a firm that didn't have a binding employment target. But a key thing that they mentioned in this paper is that it applies establishment by establishment. So that seems like this might actually be a better way to encourage productivity increases than R&D subsidies or productivity subsidies. Okay, that's what I had to say.
So thank you so much. Say a couple of things.
Absolutely.
Before I get some questions.
Pete, thank you so much. I mean, he was very kind to share his slides in advance, so it was definitely very helpful. So first of all, I discussed the paper yesterday, so I mentioned my feelings about not having met Zvi, but one thing that I would like to emphasize is that, you know, his emphasis on using data to discipline any economic analysis very much resonated with me, and then also with my students too. And he was, you know, one of course for someone who is working on innovation, he's been definitely the hero. I wish, you know, I could have had the chance to meet him, but hopefully, you know, this line of work would be also in his spirit, because now, you know, most of the macro innovation related papers are starting from data, with innovation data, with R&D data, and then we are trying to discipline the theory that way. So that's I think something that I want to emphasize. Now in terms of the comments, Pete, thank you so much. These are right spot on. You're absolutely right that these type of policies will create static misallocation by design, because of course these firms are massively oversized. There are a lot of them are unproductive. They were being inflated in terms of size, and you know, when the privatization hit, they wanted to shrink drastically. And when you stop them from shrinking, of course, you're creating a very significant misallocation, I would think. And our goal in this paper was trying to see and quantify the reaction of the firms. When we want to do, of course, welfare, I think it's very important to calculate all the misallocation, both static and dynamic, and that's what we typically do in most of our papers, right? So first we need to understand the firm behavior in a positive sense, and then we aggregate them up to see what do they mean welfare-wise. And I think the next step in this agenda, as Pete, you also mentioned, to somehow put everything together and see what are the welfare implications. We definitely don't want to give a positive spin. So, these type of policies, now we see that Germany, especially East Germany, is still paying the bill after 30 years, after having spent so much money, still paying the bill. So we definitely don't want to give the spin, but we positive spin, but we just want to put how the firms, we just want to document how firms have reacted to it.
I think we ought to get some more questions.
Sure, yeah. Sure. The only thing I would like to emphasize, is that R&D subsidy in these type of economies is, I don't think it's the way to go. It's also not the way to go in middle-income countries either, because there are already all these existing technologies, and these backward economies should be in imitation mode, not in innovation mode. So that's why asking them, such a backward economy, to start innovating from scratch is just an overkill. East Germany could have done technology transfer from west to east, and if they had done that, I think it would have been much more productive. That's the only thing I want to add.
Okay.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.